Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
So here's the thing. High holidays really start tonight, right? What are we doing tonight? Does anyone recall? Shlichot, right? Preparatory service. We confess our sins to the Lord, not just individually, but corporately, you know? And it's a kind of a preparatory service in the sense that next week, of course, we'll have Rosh Hashanah. We have the whole schedule available for you on the website and on the credenza out in the foyer. So I want to talk with you today about the high holidays and why it is so important to make them a real priority in your schedule. Now, I'm not going to go through all the reasons because I'm going to be sending out an email which details some of this. I'll talk about a couple of things and then emphasize one particular idea, which is very, very important, that puts things in a much broader context. And hopefully we'll get real excited about the things that we're going to be talking about today. So why are the high holidays important? Well, because, among other things, it's a chance for us to join with Jews everywhere, in space and in time, meaning the Jews in Iran, the few that are left, in China, in Japan, in Europe, in South America, in North America, we're all going to be doing the same prayers together. But of course, as Messianic Jews, we have some very important additions to the traditional prayers, which are so powerful and important. But we're connecting with our people. Why else? Well, here's something very important, and I could say this with some authority, that our children and grandchildren need to see the consistency of their parents if they are going to drink deeply of this fabulous Messianic Jewish experience where Yeshua is so important to us. They need to see you at services. They need to be with you. That rhythm of life, critically, critically important. There are other reasons as well. The high holidays, for us, emphasize, not just for us, for Jews everywhere, emphasize themes that we don't really get much during the year. Or if not themes, maybe the themes are there, but the enactments, the things we do. I think of Tashlich. I love, do you like Tashlich? Isn't that great? We go to Longfellow Pond and we take rocks. I've asked Chaim, Rabbi Nathan's son, if he would collect big rocks and little rocks for us. Maybe you've had a pretty sinful year. We've got a boulder for you. You know, if you've been pretty good, we've got little rocks. You throw them in the water. Someone asked me, why don't you use bread? Their custom was bread. And the reason we don't do that is because we're told that if the ducks at the pond eat the bread, it can hurt them. We care about God's creation, and we care about the ducks, and we don't want them to be hurt. And also, there's something about the imagery of our sins cast in the sea and not floating downstream as if they're still there and we can watch them, but rather they're cast into the sea and gone. There are just lots of important reasons, and I'll detail these again for you in a note that I'll send you, along with some special customs and things just to help you appreciate and enjoy the season that much more. But I want to talk about one particular reason that drinking deeply of the high holidays is particularly important. And here it is. When we, the remnant of Israel, that is the segment of Israel that embraces the true, real Messiah. I mean, we get it. We really do. When we worship on the holidays in the spirit of confession, our own sins, but also we stand in intercession for our people, Israel, we participate in the cosmic drama and the changes and the plan that God has for our world. We are not just observing that plan. We become part of it, part of it. So that, of course, begs the question, what does the plan involve? Well, that's too big for one sermon, but I can think of two things that have happened in the 20th century which are so staggeringly important, so amazing, and so unlikely that they clearly have the mark of God on them. And they're things that we are part of. We're part of. And I want to detail these things for you. So I'd like to introduce you to a book which is very good in teasing these things out. Have you heard of Jonathan Kahn before? Is that a familiar name? Yeah, Jonathan Kahn. I want to tell you, I was a little skeptical when I read his first book. The first one I read was The Harbinger. I tell you the truth, I was amazed. The kind of things that God providentially built into the history of the United States, not that we have the same covenantal status in the United States as Israel, we're not making that point, of course, but nonetheless, very striking. Then I read another one called The Paradigm. Good book, worth reading, right? Michelle, you like that one, huh? Well, he sent me an advanced copy of this one. This is The Oracle. I'm only partway through. But I just wanted to mention, worth reading, and I'm actually borrowing some material from Jonathan, so proper attribution there that we recognize that this is not strictly my own. Now, what we want to talk about, two phenomenal miracles that bring us right into the heart of the High Holidays. The first is this, the resurrection of the nation of Israel in 1948. We don't talk about it much because we assume it. It's so much part of the warp and woof of what we're all about that we don't talk about it a lot, but I want to talk a little bit about it now. Now, when you think about it, there are nations, all kinds of nations in the world, and normally they follow a pattern of you have a little group of people and they live by a river and it's a good river and they get a good leader. And before, you know, as time goes on, a nation develops, a people with a sense of identity and purpose and a place in the world. And that's the normal way things occur. But when we talk about Israel's coming back into existence, we're not talking about a birth. We're talking about a resurrection. We're talking about a resurrection. And let me explain what I mean. Let's just talk about something as simple as national anthems. Now, the United States, of course, has a national anthem. It's the Star-Spangled Banner. It was composed in 1814. But we were a country already from 1776. So the national anthem follows, eventually, there's a national anthem that kind of captures musically the self-concept, self-identification of a people. And, you know, Canada has their nice national anthem, and Britain, and everybody has their national anthem. But HaTikvah, which is the national anthem of Israel, didn't come after the reformation or the formation of the modern state. Rather, it preceded it by decades. It's actually based on a poem that was composed in 1878, and it was sung for the first time at the first Zionist Congress. You've heard of Theodor Herzl, perhaps, and the first Zionist Congress in 1898, and that's where it was first sung. So you have the national anthem preceding the existence of the nation. It's not the way it usually goes, because Israel was a resurrection, meaning that which it lost, it got back. It retrieves that which had been. It is the national anthem is not something totally new. It derives from the sense of the existence of the nation 2,000 years earlier, and then it is reborn. It is resurrected, that the nation is. Now let's talk about language. Language. Now, the way it normally goes, and this is an oversimplified version, of course, but you have countries and you have languages that develop over a long period of time, and that's all very natural and understandable. But in the case of Israel, it wasn't a matter of a nation being born and then developing a language. The language had been out of use in terms of popular usage, in the synagogue it was used, but in terms of everyday usage, for 2,000 years, there wasn't Hebrew. It just wasn't around until the middle of the 19th century, and particularly with a fellow named Eliezer Ben Yehuda, that he really was the main person to resurrect Hebrew as the ancient language, which is not easy to do. I mean, back in King David's day, there was no word for microchip. So in Hebrew, microchip, okay, not very imaginative, but the point is you had a little tiny vocabulary back then. quantum physics. You had to invent all these words. And there is a whole ministry in the government of Israel that reintroduces or introduces new words into the vocabulary because it is the resurrection of the language. It is not the birth, it is the resurrection. Let's think about this. The land resurrected. I am going to read you a few quotes from Samuel Clemens, the famous Mark Twain, one of America's great writers, often considered the first modern writer, as I understand it. And he, in 1868, he took a trip to Israel. And I want you to listen to how he described the land. He walked around and traveled around all through what was called Palestine in those days, but Israel. Here's what he says, and form a picture in your mind. One may ride 10 miles hereabouts and not see 10 human beings. These unpeopled deserts, these rusty mounds of barrenness that never, never, never shake the glare from their harsh outlines. There is not a solitary village throughout the whole extent, not for 30 miles in each direction. You get the picture of the barrenness here? You getting that picture? The valleys are unsightly deserts fringed with a feeble vegetation. That was how Mark Twain described Israel when he got back and put it in the book which became his most famous book, which launched him into public notoriety. But that's what he saw in Israel. Now, what is the situation in Israel? Well, first of all, the forests have and the flowers and the desert bloomed. Get this. The flowers that the country now produces to export have reached more than 100 in variety in Israel. 100 varieties of flowers in Israel. Flowers are the third biggest export of the nation of Israel. Samuel Clemens, nothing here. Dirt and more dirt. Today, blooming deserts. Do you think that might be something that God orchestrated in his providence? What do you think? I think so, unmistakably. Back then, I'll give you another example. Israel had soldiers in the first century. They fought the Romans. There were no Israeli soldiers for 2,000 years. But now, of course, Israel has its army resurrected. Now, I have to say by way of a proviso here that when I describe Israel in such glowing terms, we have to be a bit careful. My son David said a good thing. This goes back many years. He said, "Dad, you know, for a country, you can be powerful or you can be good, but it's very hard to be both." You get that? It's the nature of things. I want to resist the temptation to over-idealize Israel at the present moment. It is God's work. God has done a mighty miracle, but it doesn't mean that everything that happens in Israel is going to be lily white and pure and good. As a matter of fact, just as it's true in the United States, we always have to have a little bit of detachment lest we fall into an over-idealization, which is not helpful and which will actually set us up for disappointment. I don't want you to be disappointed. I want you to get the larger picture. We're talking about the High Holidays and why it's important to make them a priority. And we're saying that when we are part of the drama of the Jewish experience, we are in the midst of miracles. Miracles. That's what I'm trying to say today. Now, there was another miracle in the late 20th century, and that is the miracle of modern Messianic Judaism. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is this. In the first century, in the early centuries, maybe up to the fourth century, but scholars debate the exact dates here, and that's not terribly important for us. But let's just talk about the first century. Belief in Yeshua was an entirely Jewish thing. In fact, the big surprise back then was that non-Jews would be allowed into the family. That was the prevailing idea. So it was in those early days. But then what happened, we know, the non-Jewish ecclesia, if you will, God's work among the nations grew and grew and grew and grew. And because the center focus had been Jerusalem, but Jerusalem was destroyed, no Jews were there, by the time we had the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135, that the center of gravity shifted to other cities, and non-Jewish people just couldn't relate anymore to the centrality of Israel in the plan of God. It became peripheral for most, and sometimes even anti-Semitism crept into the mix, and that's part of the story. But at the same time, we have the growth of the rabbinic Jewish community, and in my view and in the view of the synagogue, we take that in a very positive sense, not negatively. Thank God that the Jewish community continued through the people who would develop the halakha and the norms for Jewish life. If they didn't, there'd be no Jews today. That's an absolute fact. And so we have a very high regard for the historic experience of our people, which includes the contributions of rabbis and sages through the centuries. However, for Messianic Jews, there was a negative side, and that is that we got forced out. This was all part of God's plan. This partial hardening to happen to Israel, this fact that Isaiah says, who has believed our report and to whom is the arm of the Lord been revealed? The implied answer is not many people, okay? And we're extremely privileged in that respect. But the point is that the Messianic Jews got caught between the proverbial rock and hard place, between a growing and powerful, sometimes militaristic church, and on top of that, also, we got caught between the larger Jewish community that didn't want us around. You know, there were always Jewish converts in churches. That's nothing really new. But a self-identified Jewish movement among Jews, building institutional structures and developing a theology and an outlook and a liturgical tradition, that is really miraculous. I'm telling you, if you told someone in the 1820s, by the way, there's going to be synagogues of Jews who embrace Yeshua, they would have said, right, something like that. Totally, totally unexpected. It is a miracle, but it's so in keeping with God's plan. And so in Messianic Judaism structures, we have congregations, we have the Union of Messianic Jewish Congregations, which is kind of a denominational structure, you got to have that. We have our rabbinical training school, Messianic Jewish Theological Institute. We have a rabbinical assembly, MJRC, Messianic Jewish Rabbinical Council. We have a summer camp, Camp Orla Dor, led by Rabbi Nathan and Raina and Sid and Diane and other people from around the country. And we're just part of the Messianic Jewish movement. I don't want to give the impression that we're the sum total. Certainly not. But we've made some pretty cool contributions to the mix. Now, what's the point of all this? The point of all this is that High Holidays and the motivation to come, it has to be more than just, well, my parents did it, so I'll do it. That's good, and we want to cultivate that among our children because it is a legitimate motivation. Dor vador, generation to generation. You do it, so the kids will do it. That's all part of it. But at the end of the day, we need transcendent reasons for making it a point not to go to work on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur, on Sukkot, all the services you can possibly attend. We need reasons that are rooted in the heart of God. And what I want to suggest to you is that when we are worshiping together in the spirit of intercession, praying for our people, and also just participation in the life of Israel, we are contributing, doing our part in sustaining and furthering the miracles that God is performing in our world. And eventually, those miracles will be clear for everyone to see because, and tell me if you're glad about this, God has not left this world to its own devices. He promises that in this inscrutable admixture of human freedom and our choices, both good and bad and whatnot, and His ultimate authority, He will bring good to this world. Are you happy about that this morning? He will bring good to this world. Does that make you happy? I hope so. Makes me happy too. And it motivates us to participate in what Rosh Hashanah means. Tashlich, Yom Kippur services, all the fasting, the dressing appropriately. I mean, that may seem like a little thing, but it's not. It's really, there's something to it. We're in the presence of a king. You show up nicely. All the different accoutrements, all the different elements, the totality of the worship, it's all for a purpose. God is doing miracles in this world. He is resurrecting Israel in process. He's resurrecting the remnant of Israel. All of this in preparation for the ultimate resurrection, which we read about in our Besorah portion this morning. So I want to encourage you all to take part in the Jewish holidays. Make them yours. Don't detach yourself in the name of busyness or other expediencies. He will be with us on the holidays. Join us. Join him. Because if not you, who? And if not now, when? Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
In the mouths of the house of Israel, and may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.